4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrack.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Wisconsin's poet laureate says we can find inspiration and wonder in the state's rural landscapes.
First, last week, State Senator Joe Lipum announced that he would not seek a recount in the close 6th congressional district primary between State Senator Glenn Grothman and himself.
And as a result, Grothman is largely expected to win the fall election over Democratic nominee Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris. That would send him to Washington as the U.S. Congressman replacing current 6th District Representative Tom Petri.
Petri has been considered a moderate Republican since he took office 35 years ago. He's been a member of the NAACP, a Peace Corps volunteer, an advocate for federal funding for infrastructure. Grothman, on the other hand, regarded as a staunch conservative. He's gained national attention for calls to abolish Martin Luther King Jr. Day, describing Kwanzaa as anti-Christian.
Alec McGillis is a senior editor at the New Republic. He says that this likely shift to the far right epitomizes the Republican Party's trends nationally. Alec, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, you say that the current race in Wisconsin's 6th congressional district is truly historic. Why historic?
Well, it's remarkable how much this represents what's going on with the Republican Party. I mean, this goes back earlier than Tom Petri, all the way to his predecessor Bill Steiger, who was another famous moderate senator. So you've had these two senators, two congressmen, who've represented this seat for, gosh, almost 50 years now, and now turning it over to this someone who many would consider the staunchest Republican conservative in the state legislature. It's just a really remarkable swing to have happening in a single district.
Now, is Wisconsin at the lead of a trend like this, a lead you call going to sort of the radical right, as you phrase it, or is it alone in this?
I think to some degree it's somewhat alone in it. And on one hand, it represents a general shift within the party, but it's also, as I argue, sort of representative of something that's been happening in Metro Milwaukee for some time now, where you've had the growth of this incredibly staunch conservative base in the Milwaukee suburbs. This district, of course, is not just in the Milwaukee suburbs; it extends pretty far out, more into sort of rural Wisconsin. But the part of the district where Glenn Grothman did best in the primary is Ozaukee County, which is, you know, part of the Wow counties, that have just become this just incredibly staunch conservative area, fueled, as we talked about before, partly by this very strong local talk radio market, which Glenn Grothman has been very adept at sort of using in his rise to prominence. So I see that the shift from Tom Petri to Glenn Grothman is just a very, very stark sign of just how much this kind of Metro Milwaukee, a very unusual Metro Milwaukee conservative base in the Milwaukee suburbs, just continues to make itself felt.
Now, you've said that over the past 50 years, this seat has been held by moderate Republicans. Can you describe what sort of position a moderate Republican would have held?
These two gentlemen, both Tom Petri and Bill Steiger, going back to the 1960s, they were leaders of a pretty strong movement back in the 60s of moderate Republicans. It was an organization that was founded back in the 60s to sort of lead the battle for moderate Republicanism against Barry Goldwater and other conservatives. The group was called the Ripon Society, named after Ripon, Wisconsin, which is, of course, in this district, the historic founding town of the Republican Party back in 1854. And these gentlemen were pushing for civil rights. Tom Petri not only belonged to the NAACP, but took part in a sit-down at Woolworths back in the 60s to protest segregation at Woolworths. They were both very active. Bill Steiger, back when he was a congressman, was active in trying to address the student unrest on the campuses, anti-Vietnam unrest at the campuses. So he was active in that. They were just a completely different sort of breed from much of what we see in the party today, and certainly from what Glenn Grothman represents.
And speaking of what Glenn Grothman represents, how would you describe where he is relative to Petri and Steiger?
Well, your intro mentioned a couple issues: his speaking out against MLK Day and also against Kwanzaa. The other issue that comes to mind is voting. Glenn Grossman has been leading the push in Wisconsin for voter ID laws and also for cutting way back on early voting, which the voter ID law, of course, has been struck down for the time being, but the big cutbacks in early voting are still going to stand. And this is a pretty big deal, and it's hard to find something where he's more at odds with a fellow like Tom Petri, who, again, actually belonged to the NAACP back in the 60s, and one of their big causes, of course, is trying to broaden voting rights, not limit them.
Well, we've got a clip now of Glenn Grossman. He was on this show back in July responding to a judge's overturning of a state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Here it is.
Our country was founded by many, many people for whom religion was very important, and they kind of looked America to be a city on a hill, and I think a very, very religious country among its people. And now we have a situation in which our government is openly hostile to Christianity. And by trying to make homosexual marriage legal, we are sending a message to the young people that homosexuality is no big deal, which is really what I think this effort is about.
Glenn Grossman from Central Time back in July. Now, do you see Glenn Grossman as being more likely to talk about social issues like same-sex marriage than the Republican Party establishment would maybe be comfortable with?
Right. I think it's worth noting that not everyone in the party is thrilled about his winning this primary. Back when he was making noises about challenging Tom Petri, there were plenty of Republicans in Wisconsin who were not too keen on that. Even people who find Tom Petri a little bit too close to the center still find Glenn Grossman a little too far right for comfort. Keep in mind, this is a party that has been talking a lot since 2012 about the need to sort of broaden its tent and try to make itself more inclusive and less sort of harsh sounding on certain issues. And if that's your goal, then having someone like Glenn Grossman coming to Washington is not really in keeping with that.
Now, you mentioned the conservative talk programming in that area as being part of why you see the shift happening. What is the other piece of the puzzle?
Well, yeah, of course, the talk shows are not the only part of it. In some ways, they're merely a symptom, or it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. With the other half of the equation is this other dynamic that I tried to capture in a big piece I did back in May for the New Republic about what's been going on in the Milwaukee suburbs, where you just have a demographic situation in places like Ozaukee County that is very much unlike what you find in other suburbs of northern cities. Most other northern suburbs these days have gotten more demographically diverse and also politically diverse. It's just gotten more purple politically, whereas the suburbs of Milwaukee, including Ozaukee, are still incredibly homogeneously white and also incredibly Republican. And they turn out there in just astonishing numbers. Ozaukee has the highest turnout pretty much in the country when it comes to presidential elections. And so it's just this, I have a theory about that in the piece that has to do with just the fact that the great migration of African Americans from the South arrived late in Milwaukee, and therefore Milwaukee's in kind of a demographic time lag, and the suburbs have yet to kind of diversify the way that suburbs elsewhere have done. But you just have the situation now where you have places like Ozaukee that vote just very heavily Republican and very high turnout numbers, and that does help someone like Glenn Grossman win a primary.
So Glenn Grossman, you know, as you've been talking about, has been outspoken on a lot of issues, some of them controversial. Should he win and go to Washington, does this actually translate into legislation, or is this, you know, is this example of rhetoric that's not really going to swing the political scene in Washington?
That's a good question. I mean, there's not much legislation happening in Washington these days anyway, right, because of the gridlock. And even if the Republicans were to win the Senate, as seems quite possible, you're still not going to have that much not that much happening, because Democrats will still have filibuster power in the Senate, and of course you still have a Democratic president. What I think you'll see more likely is you'll see Glenn Grossman making waves with comments and maybe certain legislative attempts, much in the way that you have Michelle Bachmann in the suburbs of Minneapolis, or Steve King from Iowa, making waves with, you know, sounding off on various subjects in ways that will get headlines and will probably cause some discomfort for the for his party, but no, will probably not have that much substantive effect.
Alec, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Alec McGillis, senior editor at The New Republic, about why he says a likely win for Glenn Grossman speaks to an overall trend in the Republican Party.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Max Garland, Wisconsin's poet laureate, has a long history with the state's rural landscape. In an essay for the Reedsburg Fermentation Festival newsletter, he says Wisconsin's farmlands and natural areas can be a source of wonder and even of artistic inspiration.
We'd love to hear from you on this. Do you stop and gaze at the rolling farmlands and pastures in Wisconsin, and do you feel a sense of wonder and inspiration out in the country? Do you have a favorite view? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
Poet laureate Max Garland joins us now from our studio in Eau Claire. His piece, Cultivating Wonder, is posted on the Fermentation Festival website. Max, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Well, nice to be here.
You write that you were re-inspired while bicycling on the loop around Reedsburg last year, I guess, during the Fermentation Fest. What did you see that got you thinking?
Well, it was hard not to be taken aback or impressed. Let's see, what did I see? I saw an operatic soprano singing on the hillside with a dress made out of corn stalks and being accompanied by a piano. I saw a 6600 John Deere that it had the metal panels taken out and replaced with stained glass. I saw a hillside in which there were dozens and dozens of kites shaped and spotted like Holsteins. And so all in all, it was a pretty remarkable, and that's not mentioning how beautiful the landscape from Reedsburg to Lime Rock and Ironton actually is on its own, but this idea of putting art out in the already beautiful landscape, that's what sort of triggered my thinking about this sort of idea of cultivating wonder.
And this isn't anything new. You wrote the piece near the Man Mound in Reedsburg. Humans have a long history of combining art and Wisconsin's outdoors.
Right. I mean, at first one might think, well, this is an unusual thing. There's art in the countryside, and this festival every October is something that, you know, might be interesting to drive or stop and look at. However, the point I try to make in the essay is that people have, in the rural areas of Wisconsin, have been making art as long as they've been here. Our great-great-grandmothers spent those long winter nights making quilts that weren't just useful, but they were beautiful. Even before, in the early days of the European settling, it was hard work in those lumber camps, but every one of them had a fiddler. So there was an understanding that art and beauty and wonder were necessary, even when the bare necessities were barely taken care of. But finally, the point I make is that for thousands of years, drums, chants, stories, songs, poems, and all of this sort of exemplified for one of the most amazing works of art, rural art, which is a 214-foot human-shaped effigy mound just outside of Baraboo that's about 1,000 years old. And that to me I was thinking about, well, this idea of fashioning something that's amazing and that is a work of art into the countryside, even into the land itself, goes back further than we really have memory of. And the day that I sat there by the Man Mound, this huge effigy mound, and wrote the essay, it was covered with thousands and thousands of violets, which coincidentally is Wisconsin's state flower.
Now, when you are out there looking at the landscape, maybe getting your own inspiration, do you feel like you're communing with the people who built that mound and the people who made those quilts?
I can't presume to know what the people, we don't even know for sure, probably the late woodland people, maybe 1,000 years ago, but there's so much that we don't know. But even an amateur such as myself, I can commune in this way. Here is a human shape. It might be a spirit, it might be a divine figure, and it's made out of earth. And every ounce of earth, every handful of earth in it is made out of living organisms. And so am I. And so at least, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be an anthropologist or archaeologist, but I can figure that much out.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Ariel in Delafield. Ariel, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love Wisconsin. I am inspired daily by just the beautiful scenery that I see while bicycling around or driving around in my area, which is the Southern Tenebrain State Forest.
And what is it? How does it inspire you? How does it make you feel?
It just makes me feel happy. I see cranes in the fields or fawns when I pull into my subdivision, or just the sunbeams shooting through the twilight sun as it goes through the white pines. Like, it's just gorgeous, and it makes me feel peaceful and calm and just full of beauty. And I think that when people take the moment to look at that sun ray as it goes through the trees, or feel the cool air as you go into the forest further, like when you take those moments of reflection, of calmness, of really a spiritual cleansing, that's really what's happening to you. And I think that helps you be just better, happier.
Ariel, thank you so much for that call. Max, I don't know if Ariel is a poet, but her description of the landscape came out kind of poetical. Does it kind of naturally flow?
It really did. It's two or three things are interesting about that. One is what she mentioned, the cranes, the deer, the white pines, all of these things that we really identify with Wisconsin, were preserved at some point. They were almost completely eliminated. The town where I am right now, is the reason that it's here in the way it is because of white pines, and they were almost all cut down in an amazingly short time. But people stopped from the brink. They realized what she realized, you know, to some extent in the nick of time. And now we understand that we work and we are a part of that. We have to manage it. You know, we have to be, if we want it to continue, we have to pass it on if we want it to keep coming. And another thing she talked about stopping.
Yeah.
We all recognize that when we fly across the country or we fly to another country, we become disoriented. We don't know where we are. We can't eat right. We can't sleep right. We're not experiencing things, and we call that jet lag. It's my contention that every time you drive across the state, which I've driven 17,000 to 18,000 miles across it in the last year and a half, you have a sort of mini jet lag. You have to wait until you slow down enough to figure out where you are, and you can see and hear and feel and smell and really get back onto human time. And I rode my bike here, and I was watching hundreds and hundreds of cars at what, you know, what we call rush hour here in Eau Claire. And I was thinking, we're in the state so often. And when we're in the state, what we don't realize is that the land itself is actually moving. Once we stop and look at the shape of the hills and the shape of the river and the streams, we realize that, oh, it's moving too. It's not a static thing. It's not inert. And once we realize, you know, pick up a handful of dirt and we realize, oh, and this is not inert. This is full of more living organisms than there are people on Earth. And once you take that time and you're slowing down, then suddenly the idea of the wonder of where you are and what your relationship to that place is begins to sort of kick in.
Do we take it for granted, this treasure we have?
Yes, we take it for granted because we are bombarded by sales pitch and propaganda and all sorts of things that cause us to want to hustle and move from place to place. We think the greatest sin is not being busy. And once you do slow down, and you think, oh, yes, this land is moving. It always was. Oh, this land is not dead. It's full of living organisms. I'm holding in my hand billions of them. And then you realize that the hand itself of 27 bones is also, it also contains many living organisms, microbes, bacteria. And so the that relationship to that place really takes you back to what I think might have been one of the messages of the people who, over the course of months, if not years, built the Man Mound, which is, this is our home. We are made of this.
We're talking to Wisconsin poet laureate Max Garland about Wisconsin's rural and natural landscapes. He says they're an amazing source of inspiration and wonder.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do you agree with this? Does this resonate with you? Call 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite view in Wisconsin? Do you just love walking, driving, soaking in the farmland? Have you been inspired creatively by those landscapes? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with State Poet Laureate Max Garland. We're talking about his recent essay on Wisconsin's rural landscapes. He says they're a source of wonder and artistic inspiration.
And you can join the conversation with a call at 800-642-1234. Do you find yourself inspired or entranced by Wisconsin's landscapes, or do you find yourself wishing you made more time to just stop and observe, watch, look, listen? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Max, before we get back to our callers, we've been talking a lot about the visual. You also write a little bit about the soundscape of the places you're talking about. What do you listen for there?
It takes a while if you're traveling across the interstate and to get that roar out of your, you know, the vibration and the roar out of your ears to start hearing and differentiating between the things that you're hearing. I was leading a group of students a few years ago and we were just doing an orientation and I was pointing out, well, that's a white pine, that's a tamarack, that's an elm tree, it's probably doomed, that's a crow, and I was doing these things, and this girl said she thought she had made a mistake. I thought I signed up for an English class, and here I was, you know, telling her what the sounds of these birds were and all that. And she said, how do you know all this? And I said, well, I live here. I mean, it seemed like the kind of thing that you should know if you live in a place, what things sound like, the names of things, the differences between trees. For many, many thousands of years, it's been necessary to know that in order to survive. And even though we may think it's not necessary, there is still something about understanding who we are and our relationship to the world in which we live that I think still makes it necessary to pay attention to the place we live and the parts of that, the sounds, the sights, the smells, the shape of the land.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Kurt on the line in Wauwatosa. Kurt, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just chimed into this program on my way home from work here, and I felt compelled to call right away. One of the things that really inspires me about Wisconsin is the ancient landscape that is so readily overlooked by many people that are not aware of the ancient landscape that's going around us. And in particular, the Epagee Mound landscape of Wisconsin. It's been a source of inspiration for me since I was a small boy, and it's one of the main reasons why I head out and spend time in the, especially a lot of the rural areas of Wisconsin. I am an archaeologist by trade, and one of the things that is really unique about Wisconsin is this ancient Epagee Mound culture that we have, and there are literally thousands of ancient Indian mounds all over the state that are being protected by various groups of people and inspired people even 1,000 years later.
Kurt, thank you so much for sharing that. We talked about one of the mounds, Max, but I like the way you put it, part of our ancient landscape that we still walk among here in Wisconsin.
I think that's true. And whenever we talk about you know, the heritage of art. We have to remember that it's been going on here for thousands of years, 10 to 12,000 years. This the confluence of the rivers where I am right now, people taught other people how to make things and how to do things and how to sing things and how to remember things. And it's a long tradition, and it's still a part of our tradition as well.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Nathan with us in Platteville. Nathan, hi.
Hi. One of the things that I always thought was amazing about Wisconsin was there's like two different types of land here. And I grew up in Platteville and Dodgeville, and just seeing the rolling hills all my life. And then when I got married, I went on a honeymoon to Minocqua. And just being surrounded by the forest and seeing the lake, it's like you have two different universes in one state. And you get to see the gorgeous rolling hills where you can see it like as far into the horizon, and then you're up in the northern part where you're just surrounded by woods and you can feel nature's closer. And it's just traveling between those two really reminds you of the great difference Wisconsin holds and why it's such one of our greatest states.
Nathan, thank you so much. I'll see your hills and forests and raise you some bluffs and a winding Wisconsin River, too. There's so much diversity, Max.
And how about those dolomite cliffs on the southeast side of Door County with the caves and all of those things that have been carved away at for the last few million years, and the driftless area south of here where all of these – the amazingly sinuous Kickapoo River. You can't believe how many times it turns. And so there's a lot of that.
Thanks a lot, Nathan, for sharing that. We'll go now to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I totally agree with what he says about the beauty of the land and just noticing all the different birds and the trees and the quality of living in this beautiful environment. I live in eastern Dunn County, close to western Chippewa County, but things are changing very quickly with industrial frac sand mining, and I don't think that, like, it worries me that what happened with all the white pines were clear cut, but those things grow back, but hills don't grow back, and our peace and quiet don't grow back, and it's close to where I live, and I'm not a person that objects to this because this is close to where I live. I didn't like it when it started over by Hoffman Hills, but now they're proposing a 2,000-acre mine in western Chippewa County. People should look at the Chippewa County website and see how big this mining industry has exploded in western Chippewa County, a beautiful part of the state. The rolling hills everyone's speaking of, those are being carted off.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Max, so you're in Eau Claire. This is going on in your neck of the woods. Is this a concern for you when you think about the future of the landscapes we talk about?
Well, I am glad that someone left the hills for us. I am glad that the river, though it's had its trials, still flows through here. And the point, I think, of what I was saying, slowing down, looking around you, recognizing what's around you, it gives you a sense of wonder. And that word is connected with awe, astonishment, amazement. And the upshot of that sense of wonder is that you want to preserve it. You want to pass it on. You don't want to take it and use it up. The river that I'm just talking about, that I crossed a few minutes ago and I'm going to cross a few more minutes, it still has a lesson for us, as those hills do, as that mound does. And the lesson that river has for us is if you want to keep it coming, you have to pass it on. And that has to do with art, tradition, wisdom, education, and certainly has to do with the beauty of a place, because the beauty is part of the value of the place. It's part of what makes our life worth living.
Go back to our callers now with Paul in Laval. Paul, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I actually live right on the route of the Farm Art Detour where you're taking your bicycle ride. Yeah, so you passed our little 10-acre farmette, and one thing I kind of noticed, I grew up in southern Illinois, and I lived 25 years in Chicago. I think a lot of local people take for granted how beautiful this area really is and how lucky we are to be here. I mean, I've traveled extensively. I've been to Europe a number of times, you know, been around the Midwest, and it's there's no other place I'd rather live than where I live right here in Sauk County. And just wanted to kind of say that.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that. And Max, can you leave us with some, I guess, art appreciation tips for enjoying the landscape that Paul was talking about?
Well, I think the last thing I would just say is that how art fits into this, whether it's something like the Fermentation Fest that's coming up October 4th, whether it's any other of the exercises of art in the rural community, is that art reminds us of that connection. It reminds us of who we are and where we come from and what's at stake. And once you see that beauty, once you experience that beauty and feel the beauty that people have been talking about, then in the words of the great American poet William Stafford, who said, "I place my feet carefully in such a world." I think that's what we want to do.
Max, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Max Garland, Wisconsin's poet laureate. His essay on Wisconsin's rural landscapes is called Cultivating Wonder. It appeared in the Fermentation Festival newsletter, and it's on their website. And the Reedsburg Fermentation Fest, as he mentioned, takes place from October 4th through 13th. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for a weekly state news roundup with WPR's assistant director, Noah Ovshinsky. Today, we're looking at the results for this week's Marquette poll and what it says about the governor's race and the race for attorney general. And new numbers on state revenue are in. We'll find out what both sides have to say.
WPR's assistant news director, Noah Ovshinsky, is back with us. Happy Friday, Noah.
It is good to be here, and happy Friday right back at you.
So we're looking to head into fall, starting to pick up steam on the elections. And, of course, we've got some new numbers to talk about. This is what we love to talk about as we lead up to elections. Polls, the new Marquette poll. And we're going to start with the new results on Mary Burke and Governor Walker. What did they say?
Well, basically, it is a very tight governor's race. In fact, it's basically a dead heat. If you dig into the numbers a bit, among those likely to vote in the election, 49% say they will vote for Burke, 47% for Walker. So Burke a little bit ahead of Walker there in those likely to vote, although that's inside the margin of error with the poll. Among registered voters, Walker has a slight advantage with 47% of respondents saying they would vote for him. Burke comes in at 44%. Again, they're coming within the margin of error. So what we have here is a very tight race.
Now, we hear from people who say, quit talking about the polls. That's horse race stuff. But are there any takeaways from this?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because of the sheer closeness of the numbers. The other interesting thing here is it shows that things really haven't changed since the last poll. And what that tells us is, especially on the campaign side of things, that, neither side has done a lot to change the calculus here. Because as far as the negative ads and those ads that are attacking either or, that they're not really catching on as far as, the residents of Wisconsin are concerned.
Do we have any more insight in who is undecided, how big that tiny little piece of the pie is about people who might be able to be changed one way or the other?
There aren't a lot of people. I mean, people's opinions are very set when it comes to Governor Walker. People either like him or they hate him. His poll numbers, favorability numbers, haven't really changed at all, really, in the last few years. Mary Burke, however, has seen her favorability increase. Now, she was a relative unknown a year ago, so you would expect favorability to increase. More and more people get to know her, so it's not surprising that that number is going up. But how many people turn out really this November is going to determine who's going to win this race. I mean, who can really mobilize the grassroots to get on the ground and get it done for their campaign?
So, and speaking of turnout, traditionally more Republicans, I gather, than Democrats turn out at midterm elections. Do we have reason to think that that could be different this year?
Well, that is the conventional wisdom. But this poll, as well as the previous one, indicate more Democrats than Republicans said they were certain to vote. Of course, all that being said, what respondents say during the survey may be different than, what happens in November, obviously. What they say on a phone call may be different than the actual voting booth. But that does show that that Democrats, at least based on this poll, are eager to vote in November, which is, for Mary Burke, a good thing.
Now, the Marquette poll also took into account another race, the Attorney General race. Walk us through that one.
Right. So I thought there was another interesting takeaway from the latest Marquette poll, and it is the Attorney General's race. At least right now, things are pretty heavily favoring Democrat Susan Happ, who is the Jefferson County District Attorney. She leads Brad Schimmel by 7 percentage points, 40% to 33%. So quite a lead here just a week or more after the primary.
Now, with Happ well in the lead, is that likely to stick through November? Do we have any sort of, you know, you're not a betting man.
Yeah.
I know this about you, Noah. We tried to make you, but what do you think?
I mean, you know, this poll is good news for Happ, obviously. I mean, it's better than being behind. But the poll revealed 24% of respondents were undecided or didn't know who they would vote for. So there is a lot of room for this election to go in either direction. And it will really be up to the candidates, frankly, to boost their own profile and really define their opponent, probably by attacking them, either, you know, in campaign appearances or on the air. But there is quite a bit of wiggle room left in that race. But it is interesting that at least at this point, Happ has a pretty substantial lead over Schimmel.
Now, you've seen a few election cycles come and go. Does this one look especially exciting to you based on, you know, certainly the governor's race, the dead heat there, but other races as well?
Yeah, what I think will be interesting, especially the connection between the governor's race and the attorney general's race, will there's excitement with Mary Burke, will that help? Will that help her, Susan Happ? Because, you know, people tend to, you know, vote for one party. So, you know, there is a chance that any mobilization efforts that will help in the governor's race may have the side effect of helping Susan Happ, at least on the Democratic side of things.
Uh-huh. So a bit of a relation there that could play out. We don't know how, but it could be something to watch.
Yeah, we'll see.
So now in other state news, we've got some new numbers out about revenue for the state last year, and revenue is down.
Right. So these are the revenue estimates, and they were just released yesterday, I believe. And these are revenue estimates for the past year. And what they showed is that the state is $281 million short, which means, assuming nothing changes, you know, whether the state gets more revenue or something, the state could be $115 million in the red at the end of next year.
Now, can you put that number in context for us? In terms of a $281 million shortfall, how significant is that when you take a look at the entire state budget?
Well, there's really two answers. If you look at the larger state budget, it's a fraction. That said, this is an election year, which means that $281 million is important because, you know, each side is arguing, you know, day in and day out that their candidate will be a better steward of the state's finances. So obviously this news, you know, certainly affects how people may view either candidate.
Now, theoretically, when would the state start feeling the squeeze from those numbers?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. Really, it all depends on what happens between now and then. Again, these are revenue estimates. So, you know, if revenue goes up more than expected, then that will certainly change. Now, the situation could get worse. Say revenue goes down. That will also affect the financial situation. So it's a little soon to tell what effect this will have next year financially. So right now it's more of a political issue than a financial one.
Now, in terms of how this is being sort of digested by Democrats and Republicans, you've got Democrats looking at the tax cuts, Republicans saying, hey, but sales tax revenue is looking good. How is this being, you know, processed so far?
Right. Well, so again, Mary Burke has sort of seized on this news. And the governor has basically said, look, you know, it's early. These are projections. And he is confident that through any combination of measures, they'll be able to make sure that the budget comes out in the black, either because those projected revenues will increase, maybe potential cuts. The governor has also suggested that he may be willing to dip into the rainy day fund, the state's rainy day fund, in order to end in the black. So again, early to tell what's going to happen, but at least this points in the direction of some financial decisions probably have to be made, you know, next year.
I'm safe bet we're going to hear more about this in the campaigns as they unfold, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, we're going to move on to something happening out of state, but the challenge to Wisconsin's gay marriage ban kept on going this week in a Chicago court. So I set the scene there.
Right. So a three-judge panel of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago heard the challenge to Wisconsin's gay marriage ban earlier this week. And of course, this is the next level for the lawsuit. And from all indications, the lawyers defending the ban had a rough time of it. All three judges, but especially Judge Richard Posner, was quite combative. When lawyers for the state suggested gay marriage bans, they preserve the tradition of marriage. Judge Posner was quick to challenge the assertion. He said it was a tradition of Western culture and one based in experience. And he went even further, saying it was a tradition really based on hate, this idea of a gay marriage ban.
And he also had some more to say. I mean, he was, of the three judges, it seems like he was the most outspoken. He gave, what he heard the roughest time, but what else did he say?
Yeah, I mean, basically the judge, Posner, he said, you know, tradition isn't enough of a reason to sustain a law. And to clearly illustrate his point, he pointed out the fact that it was once illegal for two people of different races to marry, that at one point that was tradition. And, you know, that has, of course, since been reversed and challenged. So clearly for him, tradition isn't enough to sustain a law that at least he, you know, likely sees as bad.
Any sense on the future of this or when the Supreme Court might have a hand in this case or another?
Yeah. So, you know, it's really unclear when a ruling will come down, but there is a good chance this case or another like it is going to make its way through the federal appeals process and will be taken up by the Supreme Court eventually. A few appeals courts in other districts around the country have already weighed in on gay marriage bans, and all of them have struck them down. But at the end of the day, it's unclear which one of these cases that the Supreme Court will ultimately take up. And only time will tell with that.
All right. Well, we're going to keep watching that and the rest of the country watching that as well to see which one of these winds its way to the Supreme Court. And ultimately, maybe Wisconsin, may not be. Now, to look at another story that was much talked about this week, the Kenosha, the proposed Kenosha Casino. What have we seen there this week?
Right. So this is a debate that's been ongoing now. The Menominee wanted to build a casino in Kenosha, and there are a few tribes, especially the Potawatomi, who don't want them to build a casino because they have a facility in Milwaukee, and they fear that if the Menominee build their own casino in Kenosha, that will hurt their business in Milwaukee. And the governor, really the governor's decision right now, it's basically his call. The federal government has signed off on it, and it's up to the governor to decide whether or not to greenlight this casino. And because of this sort of dispute, the Potawatomi is withholding something like $25 million in revenue payments to the state over this dispute. So again, this thing has sort of been simmering now for a year or more. And now it's really, I would say, not quite a boil, but certainly hotter than it was in recent months.
Definitely raises the stakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about real money, $25 million. Again, we're talking about, you know, this story the same week that the state is saying that they're, you know, something like what did we say, $219 million, you know, potentially projected, you know, in the red.
Well, Noah, thanks a lot for coming by and have a great weekend.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was Noah Ovshinsky stopping by for our state news roundup, and he'll be back next week at this time for the same. Noah Ovshinsky is Wisconsin Public Radio's assistant news director.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.